going to say very much, because I really don't have a lot to say. The guy that has to say it the way I like to hear it, and I've heard it for 5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it gets better all the time, is Clancy Ive.
My name is Clancy. You must learn that I'm an alcoholic. You could have said more than that. I'm a little... I'm a little hoarse this morning because there was a lot of people in our yard playing softball and volleyball yesterday, and newcomers, some of them are catatonic, and they don't realize when the ball rolls over and touches their foot, it's okay to pick it up and throw it back to the infield. I had to counsel them from the pitcher's mound rather loudly. Because there's no end to my giving. I'm glad to be here this morning. I was glad to come to Bakersfield because I've been up here so many times. In fact, I was thinking the first time I came up here was the weekend of President Kennedy's assassination. On the way home, I stopped someplace for gas and watched Oswald shoot that guy on the television. It was just a traumatic weekend. What? Are you whispering to me? We didn't whisper when you talked. Sure, I don't have my kids with me to protect me. This boob over here from Tulsa visiting. Last time I saw him, he was stumbling around the meeting in Tulsa, and I'm glad to see him. He's willing to go to any length to find truth this morning. Maybe he can go back there and tell him that, do you know what's new in California? They got stamps. I hate to get up early in the morning and drive because my heart doesn't start till about 9. So I came up last night and went to a meeting. Dan G, wherever you are, was kind enough to allow me to stay at his home last night. And they allowed me to buy him dinner. And I'm not sure, but I think when I left, he picked up the tip and put that in his pocket. But we went to a meeting last night. It just seemed to me a good meeting, but I didn't know till this morning. Bernice was telling me that I was at the world-famous Oildale meeting. I don't know what you're clapping for. You weren't there. There were a few sincere people. Joe and a few people here that were there. And we had a newcomer and we discussed life and had a good time. had a very pleasant evening's sleep and woke up this morning feeling pretty good. I'm glad to be here. It's a nice morning and a nice day out there. Nice not to have any fog and crap, and makes you remember that you're glad you're sober briefly. I used to drink, and I drank for a number of years, as most of us have. And nearly all of those years, except for brief periods when I was really sick or in jail, alcohol, I never really stopped and thought about my drinking as anything negative, because to me, alcohol was always the best. Alcohol was the best friend I've ever had. Now that sounds terrible to say that in an AA meeting, but alcohol is the best friend I ever had. People, your best friends, come and go. They move away. You get cross with them. The great job peters out, or you get sick of it. States, cities, all come and go. But when drinking is helping you, that's a constant in your life that you can use. And I discovered when I was 15 years old, early in the Second World War on the Pacific, that a few drinks made me feel like a man. But I didn't feel like a man any other way, I'll tell you. And a great many years later, I took my last drink. And by that time, I'd become much more slick and sophisticated, and I'd been around a lot. And if people asked me why I drank then, if I were in one of my moods going back to my psychoanalysis, I'd explain to them about how I'd been scarred as a youth psychologically, how I'd been hurt, how I had been warped, how I had been deprived. I didn't even know I'd been deprived till I got in psychoanalysis. I didn't know there was a depression till the 1950s. But people like me, I like to find reasons why I'm screwed up, because it takes the heat off me. I sometimes wish I were the adult child of an alcoholic. That would take a lot of it off me. But I'm an adult child of something worse. I'm the adult child of a Norwegian Lutheran. Alcoholics at least sometimes pass out, but Norwegian Lutherans never do. Just... remember one day the psychiatrist saying to me, he said, "You mean to say, Mr. Emmerslund, in 1935 at this time, you didn't even have a bicycle?" I said, "No." But I got thinking about it on the way home. I began to realize I never had anything. For about 2 months after that, every time I wanted to feel bad, all I had to do was visualize a little tousled-haired, apple-cheeked, blue-eyed little tyke standing on the streets of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, watching his little friends ride their bicycles. Don't worry about me. I'll go into analysis later. God, it used to bring tears to my eyes, I'll tell you. It took me almost 2 months to remember. Nobody in Eau Claire had a bicycle in 1930. One kid did. We thought he was a freak. We beat him up and broke his bicycle. So I was able to say why I drank. Other times, if I were in one of my metaphysical moods, dating back to my search for deep inner consciousness, people ask me why I drank, I could tell them that about the need of certain sensitive individuals to find the oneness with the life force of the universe that brings us fruition in our innermost self. I was pretty good at that for a while. I don't like to gloat. I mean, it's, you know, I know it's tough enough to live in Bakersfield without having somebody gloat. But at one time, to the best of my knowledge, I was one of six people in the state of Texas who knew truth. And that's a heavy load to carry in Texas. They don't appreciate it. It's almost a relief when they put me away. Sometimes if I were in one of my moods dating back to my studies of Nietzsche, see, imitation intellectuals do a lot of things too. And I might explain to them the problem of being born and what we know as an Übermensch. In every couple generations, there are people born who are at a different level than other people. But they don't know they're at a different level, and the other people don't know they're a different level. All they know is that they're different, so they try to destroy them. Which explained a lot to me, I'll tell you. So I could tell them that's why I drank. Or if I were in one of my normal moods and they say, "Why do you drink?" I'd say, "Why don't you go screw yourself?" But probably the truth is the last thing I would have thought of. I would never have identified it. But I'm sure I took my last drink for exactly the same reason I took my second drink. To feel like a man. And I had no idea that. I discovered that after I was sober. But all those years I drank, and I didn't drink because I was a drinker. I drank because I was, seemed to me, my emotions were too sensitive or something. I wouldn't use the word sensitive because that sounds like a non-macho ailment. And when you're feeling weak and insecure, the one thing you don't want to look like is non-macho. Better to die looking good. And I used to examine myself a lot, and I got in all these therapies. And it seemed to me that my problem was that however it came about, whether it came about from my deprived childhood or my inability to find oneness with the universe or that I was a different level than people or whatever the hell it might be, in the suit of armor that people have to live in the world, to protect them, there seemed to be holes in mine. And they were just in all the wrong places. There was a hole, for example, in that part of my armor that should have kept in my self-confidence when I needed it worst. But when the pressure's on, my self-confidence just runs out. And I get upset, nervous, and afraid. There seems to be a hole in my armor that deals with my ability to hold off anxiety. I have a tendency to have a lot of anxiety, when, more than other people, I can tell by looking at them. They don't have anxiety. I have anxiety. There's a hole in my armor that deals with an inability to withstand loneliness. Now, I know everybody gets lonely, but other people get lonely when they're alone. I have a tendency to get lonely in the middle of crowds of people. Now, there's something wrong there. I knew that. Just such little things as I always hate to go to parties or social affairs on the natch because I have a difficulty in making small talk. You ever go to a party? Everybody else knows what to say. And you stand there and you feel it. Well, going to be a scorcher tomorrow. Once in a while, get a little surge of imitation confidence and try something different, you know. See that woman in the red dress? I wonder if she puts out.
That's my mother, you son of a bitch.
Oh. Well, going to be a scorcher tomorrow. When I am on the natch, I have a tendency to be very easily rejected. Sometimes just a glance can demolish me in a critical situation. Sometimes just especially someone in authority that I'm working for, somebody whose approval I need, can look at me and it just destroys me. Or, of course, I would never show it, but I feel it. And so I can hear tones of voice that other people can't hear. And I discovered many years ago that a few drinks changes nearly all of these and many other feelings. When I have a few drinks, when my holes are full, that's the way I want to be. When my holes are full, I don't have anxiety. I may worry a little bit, but I don't have any anxiety. When my holes are full, I have self-confidence. When my holes are full, I can make small talk. What do you want to talk about? You want to talk about 1927 Yankees? You want to talk about the Baltimore Colts, New York Giants football game of 1958? You want to talk about where Lee went wrong at Gettysburg? You want to talk about German philosophers? You want to talk about the meaning of the book, The Decline of the West by Oswald Spengler? What do you want to talk about? When my holes are filled, I don't get rejected. I reject. Maybe some of you young men or older men have had that funny experience, that's a remarkable experience. Most people never have it. Of being able to sit in a bar late at night, having just a few drinks, and watching a veritable miracle appear in front of your eyes. Watching some old bag become beautiful by closing it. I might sidle up to such an old beast about closing time and imply there will be delights beyond her comprehension. She'd like to accompany me in the old car outside. Now, she says, now, when my holes are full, I don't feel rejected. I feel sorry for her. Too bad, bitch. Don't come begging tomorrow. If that would happen to me sober, with my holes empty, I might just go in the washroom and hang myself. There's the difference. When my holes are filled, that's the way I want to function. I started off my adult life as a sports writer, then I got into advertising and public relations. I did a lot of things. Directed an opera at the University of Texas. I've done a lot of things. When my holes are filled, I am just good. I'm the type of person I want to be. There's only one problem I ever had, really. It was an ongoing one, but it's a problem. I have a tendency, from time to time, to overfill my holes. Or, as I like to think, I have been thoughtlessly overserved. And that brings about another phenomenon. That phenomenon is, apparently my body has no machinery to handle overflows. Because it goes right into the electrical circuits. And I become what a number of police and some judges and a couple psychiatrists have described as bizarre. Now, there's nothing wrong with being bizarre when you're young. And boy, did we have a hell of a time last night. Peed in that hotel lobby. But as you get older and your children are getting older and they want food and lodging, becoming bizarre gets to be an inconvenience. And you're always explaining and always having to find a way to justify and explain that it wasn't really this way, and it's not the way it looks, and on and on. And I went to AA. They sent me to AA many years ago. People thought I should go to AA, and I went to AA. And it didn't take me long in AA to identify, that's not me. I'm sure these people are fine, but that's not me, because these people are people whose problem is somewhat more simplistic. Their problem is drinking. Their problem is alcohol. Mine is sometimes when I get a little bizarre. But unlike them, stopping drinking doesn't help me. Stopping drinking brings about a condition that's almost equally as bad. It leaves me with empty holes and little. There's a certain surge when you stop drinking, but pretty soon those holes begin to manifest themselves again, and you get ill at ease and anxious and tense and alienated, and little by little it gets kind of bad again. And I wish my problem was alcohol. I went to AA off and on over a number of years when people I used to think to myself, it's too bad, for example, the highway patrol. There isn't some highway patrol of the spirit where they could measure your problem. So you could blow up a balloon and they could determine how lonely you felt today. They can't take a drop of blood out of your ear and determine how anxiety-ridden you are today. And there isn't a white line to walk to measure how much love you need. And that you got to feel part of something. And you're trying to pretend you don't. But they can measure your drinking when you drink too much to offset it. So everybody thinks your problem is alcohol. And it may be for alcoholics. But it isn't for people whose case is different. And so I tried various therapeutics. I tried, as I say, psychoanalysis. Another time I went to metaphysics, read books, did a lot of things. But in looking back, I suppose my number one job was trying to find a way to fill these holes and keep away from overfilling them. To function with, because nobody likes to, it would be nice to be on the natch all the time, of course, but no one can stand feeling like a wimp whose life is just at the beck and call of everybody who looks at them funny, who just, you take crap and you overreact and you know. I quit jobs when I'm sober. I don't quit jobs when my holes are filled. I feel secure. But when I'm staying sober, I'm trying to hold a job and somebody says, "Why did you do that?" I say, "Screw you. Take your job and shove it, God damn it." And then later I think, I wonder why I said that. Work for months and years to get into a great situation and then blow it, because that day you got to prove that you don't care when you really care so much you can't stand it. It really gets to be a drag. So my job was to try to hold those things together and make a new start. And every so often I got bizarre, and every so often when I become bizarre, I'm not bizarre. I mean, I was 1950s bizarre. Today I could be chaplain of the campus, you know, but then they called it bizarre. And I tried a lot of things, but in looking back, it was always knowing that I had to do it. And I didn't realize the nature of my problem. I'm sure that's the truth of most people like me, or like you, I suppose, because it gets down to this. You know, there are some new people here today. You look around the room, what do we all have in common? We all drank the same? Not at all. We all drank the same amount? Not at all. We all come from the same backgrounds? Not at all. We all have the same skin color? No. We all have the same religion? No. We all have the same history? No. There's nothing we have in common, really. Nothing. Except one thing. That's quite obvious. If you're here this morning as an alcoholic. That was something that was read earlier this morning. You may have heard it read a lot of times, as I did, and not realize this is what we have in common. Each of us have again and again in our lives been pushed into a situation where we had to readopt the obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing, was read this morning. Now, why would you get that way? Because of the nature of the illness. You know, it's an amazing thing. This thing that we have, one of the greatest symptoms of it is my own brain proving to me I really don't have it and trying to find differences between me and them to prove I don't have it. And I'll tell you, over the past few years, I had an opportunity to have a couple of people I sponsor in cancer wards dying. And I used to laugh about that and think, not laugh funny, but it's an amusing concept. If I could go into that cancer ward where the people are dying for wards around me and say, hey, would you be willing to go to a meeting every night if I could get you out of here and get rid of your cancer? And they'd jump out of that bed with cry, sob, tears. You find, see these young men, I see them once in a while now with AIDS. They're dying. There's no way to stop them. And say, would you take some actions that you don't necessarily believe in to get over this AIDS? You bet. Anything. But you find someone who is an alcoholic and you say, would you be willing to do some of these things? And the answer is, you don't understand. That's not my problem. And it's funny, except the next line that was written this morning, that was read this morning, said, many pursue it into the gates of insanity and death. And they really do. And it doesn't seem that way because you don't see it happening at AA meetings. But it happens. Almost every day of my life now, my working life, I see alcoholics die. Now, I don't mean die figuratively where they get sick. I mean where they put a blanket over them and send them to the morgue. And I see alcoholics moving themselves across that line into irreversible brain damage. I see that every day. I don't think that's an exaggeration. Of course, it's easy to say, well, you work on Skid Row. Of course you're going to see it. But I'll tell you something. The deaths from alcoholism on Skid Row are only 3%. That leaves 97% of people like you and me. There will be more deaths from alcoholism in Bakersfield in the next 30 days than are on Skid Row in Los Angeles, where there's thousands of drinkers. I'll tell you. Of course, many of them aren't called deaths of alcoholism. They're called deaths from other things because no family likes to put down alcoholism or even selects it. One of the great tip-offs, when you see a death that's listed as heart failure, you think there's something wrong here because that's what causes everybody's death. The problem is, what makes that heart fail? That's what makes the problem. But it talks about people like us. And it says, as you go along, there are occasional brief recoveries. We've all had those. Followed always by still worse relapse. And we've all had those. God, there must be something big going on outside. Maybe the drawings out there are. Till you get to a stage of what? Great choice of words. I read this 500 times before. As a writer, the choice of the words is just exquisite. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Now you think that's how drunk you get. You get just pitiful or incomprehensible. But I'll tell you something, that is not what that means at all. That's how you get the next time you're sober. That's how you feel when you get sober. We talk a lot in AA about drunks committing suicide. Everybody, you know, a few years ago I was on an AA talk show in Los Angeles. A central office sent me over. They're always sending you to some stupid place. And they had me on there as Alcoholic Al to protect my animal. And this guy was before they had people call in. He was taking me through my story. And he stopped me. He said, Al, did you say that you were on the faculty of the University of Texas and you got so despondent that you committed suicide and went in the garage and committed suicide and a neighbor found you dead and brought you back to life and they committed you for an indefinite period at the Texas State Insane Asylum? Did you say that, Al? I said, yes. I just said it. It wouldn't surprise me. And he had big tears in his eyes. And he said, Al, I've been in this business a long time, but you're the first person I ever met who actually tried to kill himself. I guess I'd been in AA too long. I said, for God's sake, you're the first person I ever met that didn't. What kind of life is it without an occasional suicide attempt? But here's an interesting thing. Most drunken suicides fail. And that's a mystery to a lot of medical people. Why do they... I mean, they just don't seem to work out. Some work out, and of the ones that work out, they feel many of those are accidental. Because the person was trying to get to help when they died. And they can never figure that out. I think the reason is quite simple, in a sense. It's because drunks commit suicide to punish other people. To make them sorry. To look how you've treated me. Look what you've done to me. And I guess as they start to go under, they start to realize, I'm not going to be here to watch them be sorry. The question is, how can I look as though I committed suicide without hurting myself? Sometimes you get a call like I have. Clancy, I just want you to know I'm checking out. I took an overdose pill. I'm going to die. I don't want anyone to bother me at 411 7th Street. It's funny, but it's serious to them. Do you know when most alcoholic deaths are successful, suicides are successful? Shortly after becoming sober. And there are no long suicide notes, because it isn't to hurt anybody. It is to destroy me. It's called pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. In AA, we know that as a bottom. And you think, once I had that, boy, I should learn my lesson. But I'll tell you something funny. The human body is able to provide scabs psychologically. And if you can survive it, it gets better. And pretty soon you can start the whole process over again and reach a new pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And again and again. And I'll show you the great insight into this. Today, there's the therapy in the world that was never there in the history of cancer to alcoholism that has worked better than any therapy in the history of mankind. It's called AA, of course. And it's available all over. It's available in most countries. It's available everywhere in America. You can't get very far away from an AA meeting. And it always works if you do the things. And so you and I are out of the woods. Most of the people ahead of us had to fight and die, but we got it knocked. Except for one thing. Today, there's a way that works, and it's available everywhere. And still, 95% of alcoholics die drunk in America. And I'll tell you something sadder than that. A number of people in this room this morning will die drunk. Maybe me, maybe you. Don't know who's going to be. Because it isn't based on how you feel now. It's based on some abstract crisis in the future as to whether or not you have kept yourself to a minimum degree of spiritual fitness, or whether your mind has taken you away from all of this dreary AA crap, or whether you are so deeply in love you don't have time to take care of yourself, or you're pursuing a buck, or you're just sick of all this crap. And people die every day who've been sober and feeling good in AA before that. And we're slick and had it all together. Now, why is that? Why in the world would that happen? And it boils down to a critical and lethal misperception of what's wrong. And most of us have had it. Most of us have had that idea. Why would you drink after it's doing this stuff to you? Anything else you do, whatever it would be. If you have just loved orange juice and it finally began to make your face break out and make you sick, you might go to a doctor. He says, It's orange. I've been drinking orange juice for 40 years. Doesn't make any difference. That's what it is. You stop orange juice. You don't have to get a sponsor, for Christ's sake. You don't have to call up in the night and say, could I just have some near orange juice? It turns out that one thing I wound up finally losing my family. They stuck with me as long as they could. And my home and my occupation and my front teeth. Yeah. I those kicked out the Phoenix, Arizona drunk tank one morning. I lay on the floor. And you can get new families and new homes and new occupations. But like our book says, we are like men who have lost their front teeth. We never grow new ones. Whatever it says. If any of you new people have lost teeth and you're drinking and you feel physically unable to cope with it, let me give you some hope. Once you become spiritual, they grow right back. They, have your sponsor explain that to you sometime. But I stood on the streets of Skid Row in Los Angeles, and this something can't happen to me, or it could happen to me because I got a strong body and could keep going. And a person would have come and put a lie detector in my arm and said, are you an alcoholic? I'd have said, no, I'm not. Based on 9 years around AA, based on psychoanalysis, based on everything I knew. I'm dying, but I don't know what's causing it. It's just an endless series of bad breaks and misunderstandings and people screwing me around. It's easy to laugh. You have no idea what that feeling's like. That's why it's kind of surprising today to find myself leaving lovely Santa Monica last night and coming up here all the way to Kern County so I could stand here this morning, have those delicious eggs. I loved them. They were so good, I didn't want to keep them myself. I shared with a newcomer. Just so I could stand at this podium and say this to the new people. Why can't you recognize your problem the way we did in the old days? Now it's been going on 28 years since I've had a drink or a pill or any marijuana or any medications for my emotions. And the best psychiatrist I ever knew said even if I stopped drinking, I'd have to have something for my emotions because they were so intense. And as you can tell, I look different than I looked then. I had a T-shirt, an old pair of pants and pennies on then, and no front teeth. I got that way this morning. I was going to say I have a wide choice of clothes, but if I would have, Gannon would have said, why did you wear that goddamn coat then? I don't need you anymore, kid. Get out. But the most important thing I've said this morning, or I'll say before I sit down, I said a long time ago. Nobody paid any attention to it. Nor should you. I wouldn't know. I said, my name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. That was the single most difficult thing I have ever had to come to believe in my life. How can you be an alcoholic when your problem is not really alcohol? It's just a contradiction in terms. AA is a nice place, but it's not for me. I was in bad shape, but I got a sponsor who was rather tough on me. I didn't intend to. And I was feeling so bad that I played his sick little game for a while. I guess it was a sense of no self-worth or something. I let him abuse me. Because I am by nature a rebel, and I do not take direction lightly.
We were at a meeting last night. Some young man was talking about how he's been slipping so long, and he feels he needs a sponsor, but he doesn't accept direction. Keep on going, boob. If you live, you will. But I took actions I did not believe in. I did things I didn't believe in. I lived in an abandoned car. The only thing about it was in the AA club parking lot, so there's a certain spiritual fallout. But I hated it, and I had given up any hope, really, realistic hope, that things would get better, because I'd blown everything so much. And I survived long enough. Funny thing about AA, if you're there and desperate, you're listening, you get pieces of information. You get a piece of information here, and another piece of information there. And it's like a jigsaw puzzle where you get things on various sides. None of them ever fit. I mean, they're all good information, but they mean nothing. If you survive long enough, eventually some of them begin to fit together. You begin to see a pattern, but that's a hard thing to wait for, you know. It's a horsey. Yeah. But it's a bitch for a while. And I'm glad I survived long enough to learn the single most important fact I've ever learned about my illness or the recovery. I'm going to say this very slowly because it's going to sound very upside down to many of you. I had to survive long enough to come to understand that if my problem is alcohol, I am not an alcoholic. Or conversely, if I am an alcoholic, my problem is not alcohol. Doesn't that sound upside down? It's like these fringers who hang around the edge of AA with better ways all the time. But I believe that's the premise of this book. I believe that's the premise of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never had seen anything to question it in over a quarter of a century. I believe that's what we all are due here, whether we know it or not. You say, but how can that be? Everybody knows that alcohol is the problem. I can disprove that in 10 seconds. If alcohol is the problem, detoxes turn out winners. Hospitals turn out winners. Treatment centers turn out winners. Jails turn out winners. Toilets turn out winners. You can talk all you want about it, the detoxes and all the famous hospitals, but still most Americans get detoxed in front of a toilet. Very few people in here who have not knelt in the morning and gazed into those shimmering waters. Waiting for a meaningful answer to surface. Say your morning prayer. Oh, God. You hardly ever think you're getting a detox. Look, fellas, this isn't going to go on the insurance. If you suffer from what I suffer from, it's not alcohol. But if you suffer from what I suffer from, the chances are astronomically high that you will die from it and never know what was wrong. And it is not alcohol. It is something that sounds like alcohol, and we talk a lot about drinking around here, so it's easily confused. But it is not alcohol. It's something called alcoholism. And the difference between an alcohol problem and alcoholism has many ramifications. I was telling someone, tomorrow night I have to talk to a group of psychiatrists in Anchorage, Alaska, and talk just about those differences, but for the purpose of an AA meeting. The difference is just this. With an alcohol problem, you stop drinking and things get better. In the disease of alcoholism, you will discover that stopping drinking has no significant effect except to gradually make your life more painful. It sounds funny, but it is deadly. That's what makes alcoholism deadly. It's the growing pain of sobriety. And you get, there's a certain surge when you stop drinking. And your voice is going to be all different. But it isn't very long after that before your old friends come through the door again. I said earlier, anxiety and tension and loneliness and alienation and frustration and defiance and being sick of being treated like a piece of crap and on and on. You get to a point one day where it's very, very, the hopelessness comes back and the despair. And one day you realize, man, drinking is not my problem. Drinking is giving me some relief of the pressure. In fact, scientists who study alcoholics say that some people get to a point where they literally must drink to preserve their sanity. That's how bad it can get. Now, so we've seen the lethal end of it is alcohol. Now you think, well, Jesus, that's tough. I'm going to tell you something. Even that doesn't make you an alcoholic. There are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who have all those feelings who are not alcoholics. They are known medically as intense or acute neurotics. They see reality as it is, but respond emotionally and obsessively and over-respond and all the things we do. Those are the people that doctors traditionally prescribe slowing down medications for. The Librians, the Valiums, the Darvons, the various things to hold them down so they don't snap. If they snap, they become psychotic, which means you don't see reality anymore. You see a distorted view of reality which reduces the conflict in your brain. Now, here's a funny thing. Alcoholics almost never become psychotic. The cases of alcoholics becoming psychotic is almost invisible. You say, but how can that be? That the rank is the second greatest cause of insanity. They do. It does. But it's not from that. Alcoholic insanity is not an emotional problem. It is a physical problem. When enough of your brain cells have been desiccated or dried out, so they are no longer functioning, and they don't revive, brain cells don't revive like most cells do, you get to a point where you can't function. That is called alcoholic insanity. A lot of us have had feelings sometimes, especially when you're new. You wonder, have I gone too far? Have I drank too much? But I'll tell you something. If you're still worrying about it, you're all right. I'm sure most of you have never seen a case of alcoholic insanity, nor will you. It isn't someone acting silly in a meeting. People with alcoholic insanity sit on a chair or on a bed, and people come and feed them three times a day and change their diapers and put them to bed and get them up and change their diapers and feed them. And they stay like this, and they can never, ever get better. It's like the last stages of syphilis, except for one thing. Syphilis has the decency to kill the patient. In alcoholic insanity, or that syndrome, you can stay like that for 40 years. Never know your name. Never know who you are. That isn't psychosis. Psychosis is when the pressure is so great that your brain instinctively changes its perception of reality to reduce the conflict. And once you become psychotic, you almost never become non-psychotic again. You hear people say, oh, psychotic? No, I'm not. Once you're psychotic, it's about one in a million that ever would get back, because that's a permanent condition. Why don't alcoholics become psychotic? Because when it gets bad enough, long enough, they'll drink alcohol. So it begs the question, why don't these neurotics drink alcohol and they won't snap? I'll tell you something funny. They do. But it doesn't relieve the pressure. Because something else must be present in order to be an alcoholic. Alcohol has to have a special effect on you it doesn't have on most people. Way over 90% of people. And we've all heard that. Well, what special effect? Sure. What's the special effect? Well, You get the impression sometimes if you're a real alcoholic, you stay drunk all the time. You hear people talk about that before.
I stayed drunk 25 years, night and day.
Since I've been sober, I've had the opportunity to work in medical corporations, and I'll tell you something. It is physically impossible for a human body to stay intoxicated 14 straight days and nights in a laboratory. You can't stay drunk. You know, in fact, that's one of the rottenest parts about being a drinker. You get sober again and again and again. If you could stay drunk, we'd have a much smaller crowd this morning. We'd have a different speaker, I'll tell you that. You might still be the toast of the Chinese palace in downtown Juarez, Chihuahua, Mexico. Here I am back, you lucky spicks. But you can't, that is not the special effect. You can't stay drunk. Well, they say, if you're a real alcoholic, you can't handle alcohol very well. You handle it badly. Not true. Any number of studies, they're getting more often now. Alcoholics should be able to handle alcohol better than non-alcoholics. In fact, if... Will you stop that? Now I've lost my place and I have to start over. My name is Clancy. You must know. But if any of you have ever been in your drinking days at parties where everybody drank the same, I would almost bet that you drove them home. They didn't drive you home if you all drank the same. In fact, social drinkers are among the worst people to be, you know, what's the worst night of the year? The one I always hated, New Year's Eve, right? All those amateur drunks. Just they don't know how to drive. They drive like this. They never learn what we take for granted. Boom, 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 boom. Anybody in this room has at least 15 seconds to know when you're going to throw up. You just... Anybody got a cert? They don't know. They just don't recognize what's going on there. You've been talking to them.
When I said to her, I said, blah!
Is it that if you're an alcoholic, is the special feeling that you become bizarre and crazy? A lot of people think that. But I've been watching people die now for many years from alcoholism. Some of them are bizarre, some aren't. Some are very introverted. They get worse and worse introverted. Some of them just become almost non-communicative the worse they drink. We get a lot of the bizarre people speaking at our AA meetings because they have bizarre stories and they're more interesting. But some of the saddest stories are the people get up and say, I have no big story. But they talk about their emotions. Is that the name of the game? Well, what is it then? What does alcohol do to me that it doesn't do to my children? I've raised all the children, all grew up. None of them, they're all doing well. I just want to shake them. I was talking to my oldest daughter the other day. She's in charge of creative writing at the University of New Mexico. And she's got a daughter graduating from high school this year. And I was explaining to her, you know, you can't be doing well. You're the adult child of an alcoholic. She said, I am doing well, and that's all I'm going to say about that. Makes you just wonder what it all means. But all my kids have grown up, none of them drink, none of them take dope. Damnedest thing. My parents. What does alcohol do to me? It doesn't do to them, doesn't do to my wife, doesn't do to my parents. As far as I can tell, nothing. Nothing. does nothing to me, in fact, maybe less than it would do to them. So he said, well, what is this special effect then? There's a big paradox. Not at all. The special effect is something I wouldn't have thought of in 10,000 years by myself. Because I had no way to measure it. You can measure what it's doing to you, but the special effect is just the opposite. Alcohol does something special for me, not to me. What does it do for me? It almost instantly alters my perception of reality. It almost instantly changes my relationship to my environment, whatever the hell an environment may be. It almost instantly makes me larger and more self-contained, and them smaller and less threatening to me. It almost instantly fills my hole. And I never had the slightest inkling it doesn't do that to nearly almost everybody else. It only does it to a few people, relatively speaking. And if it does that to you, or for you, it has one other little price tag. Every time it does it for you, it erodes your holes another 1/16 of an inch. So by the time it's starting to do something to you, pretty soon, reality is untenable. There's a syndrome sets up where you stay sober, and then you drink, and then you get sober, and then you drink. Both ends are now untenable. That is called alcoholism. And nearly everybody who has it dies from it because they say it isn't the alcohol, it's these real things that are eating me up. And the reason that's important to remember, so you might begin to understand, the function of Alcoholics Anonymous is not to get you sober so you can feel good again. Being sober is not the goal of Alcoholics Anonymous. Being sober is the entrance to Alcoholics Anonymous. After you get in there, you somehow must do things, or else you must surely leave being sober, sooner or later. And it really doesn't make any difference whether you leave being sober by taking medically prescribed medications for your nerves, or smoking marijuana, or doing any number of things. The point of AA is not to get off alcohol abstractly. The point of AA is to take people that cannot live without softening reality and give them a way to live without softening reality. And that's why we have involved steps. And it's very difficult to understand them. Most of us have to take actions long before we understand it. Most of us have to have sponsors that we make some surrender to. Because that's the big surrender. It isn't surrendering mouth lip service. It's surrendering your judgment in moments of crisis. I remember we were saying this last night. I was telling my sponsor years ago. I said, in my judgment right now, writing an inventory would kill me. And he said, in your judgment, if I wanted your judgment, I'd go down and put my head in the back seat of that abandoned car and ask you, who gives a shit about your judgment? You live like an animal. I live in a big house in Pacific Palisades. Terribly cruel. I almost turned that old man in. If I would have had the money, I would have called the World Service Office in New York and just wants you to know there's an old timer in Los Angeles killing newcomers. Now it's 27 years later. When I talk to the World Service Office in New York, I say, no, I'm not. And I'll tell you, we're running a tad late, so I want to get this done with. What is the purpose of AA? It's people. It's involvement. It surrenders. It's continual going. Is it to make you wonderful? No. You'll never rise above human beings. Is it to make you flawless? No. Is it to give you a perfect, carefree marriage? No. In fact, be very suspicious of people who say, our marriage is just wonderful every day. There'll be some problems there pretty soon. Because they can't deal with problems because they pretend there aren't any. When I was sober about 5 years, that same wife moved back out here and brought the children. We've been living together for many years. But we got along very well. They realize this is their last chance. The point of AA is to do something that is almost impossible to even explain to people, to say nothing of having it happen, over a period of time, to slowly alter my perception of reality, to little by little to change my relationship to my environment, to little by little to make myself larger and more self-contained and them smaller and less frightening to me. To little by little fill my holes. Now, unfortunately, the holes you have as human beings can't ever be successfully filled all the time. Through some celestial prank, there's a tiny hole in the bottom of the big hole. Every time you get that baby filled, you just, oh, I got it together now. It's just, oh, shit. So you got to keep filling it. So you keep taking simple actions. It's a simple program. And the problem is to survive long enough to discover that simple answers will help your complex problems. And you need help. That's the greatest gift we have here. That's why we gather together. That's why people sponsor one another. That's why we have service work. That's why we take the action. That's why we take the steps, not to help the people. I don't make amends to people for them. I do it because it helps redress my misperceptions of reality. I've never really hated anyone after I made amends to them. It's a funny thing. I hated a lot of people. That's why we have a central office. That's why we gather together to keep the central office going as the disseminator of information. And the sad thing is, most of the people who get the information will never understand it or believe it. And they will die from it. But once you're here, and once you get some glimmering of why you're here, for God's sakes, work to keep it. Because if you lose it, it's all over. I don't know anything. I know of no philosophy in the world. And I've studied a lot of them, and I've done a lot of things. I've never found anything except AA. Or I should say, AA is the only thing I've ever found that has not eventually disillusioned me. Now, AA has apparently disillusioned me many, many times over the past 27 years. But if I keep doing the things and taking the actions and making the surrenders, it comes back. Nowhere else does that happen. So I'm glad to be here this morning, safe and sane and sober, to take part in this, in a sense, celebration of sobriety, to keep the central office open. But that is the number one reason. You and I must, every time we do these sort of things, every time you go to a meeting, you must remember why I am here, if you can, to rededicate yourself to the premise that I have to keep my environment shaped up. I have to keep my relationship good to the world as I can as a human being. I have to put forth better vibes than I would like to put forth a lot of times in order to live in the world, in order to keep the world shaped up, in order to keep my holes filled most of the time, to enable me to function the way I always wanted to live. And can't always do it, but can do it a lot. The only therapy I've had since 1958 is Alcoholics Anonymous. And there are people around now who say that, well, AA is all right, but therapy X is better. And once you get sober a while, insight Y or blaming it on this group or that group. I'll tell you, I've been in jail 37 times. I've been strapped down in hospitals. I was once upon a time confined, theoretically, for the rest of my life to the Texas State Insane Asylum. I've lost everything I have. I think I can speak for the emotionally upset. And I will tell you that AA by itself and doing it works at least for 27 years and 5 months. I don't know if it'll work any longer than that, but it works that long. Try it.